This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Saturday, February the 23rd. It's called Once in a Boo Moon, and it's a benefit for KBOO featuring some of KBOO's music programmers.
Henry and Moggy will be there doing their down-home country ragtime.
The True Vine Ramblers, including Ian Joel doing traditional bluegrass.
Don McLaren and his fiddling friends doing old-time fiddle tunes.
And topping the bill, Retta Christie and her one-night stand band doing country jazz.
That'll be from 7 until 10 p.m. at Parish Hall, St. David of Wales Episcopal Church, Southeast, 28th and Harrison.
You can get tickets at brownpapertickets.com.
To get more information and get your membership discount code, go to kboo.fm/boomoon2013.
See you there.
Tune in this coming Tuesday, January 29th at 6 p.m. for the first in a monthly series that will run throughout the year 2013, KBOO's 45th anniversary year.
Tune in, turn on, and remember, 45 years of KBOO Community Radio.
If you have a story about KBOO that you want to share for this series, contact KBOO's station navigator at navigator@kboo.org or find out more at kboo.fm/stories. Tune in, turn on, and remember, 6 o'clock this Tuesday, 90.7 FM.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News...
The corporation behind a massive tar sands pipeline sues the activists trying to stop it.
A Portland police officer accused of sexual harassment is removed from his job in the sex crimes unit.
An ACLU spokesperson responds to President Barack Obama's Tuesday announcement to immigration reform. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, January 29th, 2013. I'm Ren Green.
And I'm Alex Ward. TransCanada, the multinational giant behind the proposed Keystone XL tar sands pipeline, is filling crushing lawsuits against individual activists with tar sands blockade and rising tide, who are trying to stop the controversial project. The lawsuit is known as a strategic lawsuit against public participation, otherwise known as a SLAP. Slaps are often used against people who lack resources or cannot afford to stand up to a corporation in court. In response to the slap, the Civil Liberties Defense Center wrote, quote, short of a gun to the head, a greater threat to First Amendment expression can scarcely be imagined, end quote. Despite the intimidating factors, those targeted by the corporation's lawsuit vow to continue the fight to protect, quote, their homes and futures from toxic tar sands. But a number of those targeted by the lawsuits have agreed to a settlement with the company in order to avoid the massive legal costs of continuing the court battle. Spokesperson and defendant of tar sands blockade, Ron Seifert, spoke on KBOO's Air Cascadia this morning.
Well, the defendants named in this slap suit did settle with TransCanada on Friday. That was before a hearing to decide what type of injunction a judge would impose on the tar sands blockade and individual defendants. What TransCanada, the pipeline company, was asking for was an injunction to prevent anyone from encouraging, affiliating with, facilitating, aiding, or helping out in any way the resistance to the pipeline. Instead, what was settled on is that the defendants named would not actually trespass on the easement themselves, but have no restrictions on what they can do outside of the easement or blockading the easement. It's certainly not an ideal situation, but that being said, TransCanada has attempted to grossly exaggerate the impact of this settlement. This by no means stops tar sands blockade or will it squash grassroots resistance to this pipeline in Texas or Oklahoma. certainly it's a situation being stuck between a rock and a hard place. These are things that should not be compromised. However, in rural East Texas, with the politics that exist, it was local council litigators had suggested that the blockade had, at best, maybe a 1 in 10 chance of being victorious in a courtroom. So it was an unfortunate situation, but we are certainly not stepping back, and the blockade will continue.
That was Ron Seifert with the Tar Sands Blockade. As part of the settlement, the activists agreed to no longer trespass or cause damage to Keystone XL property, including demonstrations aimed at interfering with construction. The settlement will not stop individuals unknown to TransCanada or groups other than Tar Sands Blockade or Rising Tide from engaging in nonviolent civil disobedience or disruptive activity to try and stop the construction of the Keystone XL, largest tar sands pipeline in history.
A Cottage Grove employee was fired as a result of an embezzlement investigation. The employee reportedly used a loophole in computer software to access the city's utility funds. The name of the employee and the sum of money were not disclosed. The Eugene Police Department, Lane County District Attorney's Office, and State Police are investigating to determine the scope of the crime.
Daimler Trucks warned workers of potential layoffs across its manufacturing sites. In Oregon, about 1,000 work at its Swan Island factory and nearly 2,000 at its Portland-based headquarters. The heavy-duty truck maker will release more details later this week. The news arrives just over a year after Daimler announced plans to hire at least 1,500 workers at its U.S. factories.
Unemployment checks may be direct deposited into bank accounts in many states, but to get that money, the unemployed must pay fees that vary on a state-by-state basis. Oregon's fees are among the lowest. KBOO's Don Merrill has more.
Jobless Americans are paying millions in unnecessary fees to collect unemployment benefits because of state policies encouraging them to get their money through bank-issued payment cards, according to a new report from the National Consumer Law Center. Lauren Sanders is a spokesperson for the group. She started out by explaining how this situation came to be.
Well, a lot of states have been looking to save money and get rid of the expenses of paying by paper check. And so they're moving to prepaid cards. And prepaid cards can be much better than a paper check for somebody who doesn't have a bank account because they get their money faster, safer, and avoid check cashing fees. But everybody should always have the choice of direct deposit to their own account first. And most states, including Oregon, do offer direct deposit first. There are some states that are requiring use of the prepaid cards and some that have a lot of fees. Oregon is actually one of the success stories. Our report shows that Oregon's card has improved considerably in the last couple of years. Oh. Oregon is about in the middle of a pack. About 55% of Oregon workers get their money by direct deposit, and the rest use the prepaid card.
So then, is there any kind of anything planned to make it easier for people, even though Oregon is one of the best states? I mean, people are still having to pay a fee to get out their own unemployment money. Do you know if there's any kind of legislation that is going to help those folks get a break on how much they have to pay to get their unemployment checks out?
No, I don't think there's any legislation plan. I think Oregon could, look to the states like Minnesota to do a better job of getting money into people's own accounts through direct deposit. But the Oregon prepaid card has definitely improved. In our last report, we gave it a thumbs down because it had overdraft fees and bank teller fees and ATM fees, and they've gotten rid of most of those fees as long as you stay in network ATMs. So the card is a lot better. It's better than a paper check, but direct deposit is still the best option. And Oregon is about in the middle, but they could do more to encourage direct deposit.
That was Lauren Saunders of the National Consumer Law Center talking with KBOO's Don Merrill about the report on bank fees for withdrawing unemployment payments.
The city of Portland has just released a report on the impact of lobbying efforts on locally elected officials. For more on the report, KBOO's Don Merrill spoke with Deborah Scroggins at the Portland City Auditor's Office.
The lobbyist program exists to kind of shine some light on lobbying activities that may influence city officials. The program is primarily revolving around disclosure. So city officials disclose any gifts that they have received over a certain amount. And then lobbying entities also disclose lobbying activities over a certain hourly threshold.
And how long has the city been producing this report?
The ordinance regarding the lobbying program passed in 2004, and the lobbyist program really ramped up in 2006.
And what is the report intended to do?
Well, there's several reports that go along with the quarterly reporting. And that is a couple of reports regarding city officials, a couple of reports regarding lobbying entities and their activities. And it's really just intended to disclose activities regarding lobbying and city officials and make, you know, to preserve integrity in the public decision-making process.
And is there any kind of report that shows that those reports have, in fact, you know, reduced the kinds of problems that the reports were created for?
There are a lot of national studies that show that simply disclosure brings more awareness and reduces influence. For specifically to our program, that there is no report about that, no. I think it's important to remember our program is primarily about disclosure and making that information open to the public. And quarterly, folks can go online to the auditor's office website and view those reports and see which organizations have been lobbying and what gifts that city officials have been receiving. And I encourage them to do so.
That was KBOO's Don Merrill speaking with Deborah Scroggins at the Portland City Auditor's Office about a report detailing the latest lobbying efforts on locally elected officials.
We are now in the third week of the trial of local teen Mohammed Mohammed, and KBOO News is continuing its live coverage from the federal court in Portland. Mohammed is charged with allegedly attempting to blow up the Christmas tree lighting ceremony at Pioneer Courthouse Square in 2010, but his attorneys argue that he was entrapped by FBI agents who spent more than a year trying to convince the 18-year-old to engage in violence. KBOO's Joe Meyer has been at the courthouse and joins us live in studio for an update. Welcome, Joe. Yeah. I understand the government rested their case yesterday. Who did the defense call for witnesses?
Well, the defense's first witness was the defendant's father, Mr. Asim Bari. He started by recounting how he came to the U.S. in 1993 as a refugee from civil war-torn Somalia. In August of 2009, he first became concerned that his son was trying to get overseas. He had read of Somali-American youth from Minneapolis being brainwashed into returning to Somalia and joining the fighting there, so he called the FBI to ask for help. When the FBI showed up, he was surprised to learn that they were from the Joint Terrorism Task Force. He asked why. You know, why was this? He said he loved America. He was so grateful to America. God bless America. And that he didn't have anything to hide. And the FBI said that since Mohammed was over 18, they couldn't do anything. On cross-examination, Mr. Knight for the government asked if the father called the FBI because he thought that the son was brainwashed. And the father shouted back, "The FBI brainwashed my son." That was kind of the first time that discussion got a little bit heated on the stands. The defense next called a series of character witnesses, friends and teachers from high school and college. I think the point of that testimony was to show that Mohammed was a regular guy, a regular teen. He had a wide range of friends across racial and religious lines, you know, pretty far from the religious extremists portrayed by the government.
So in addition to his father and character witnesses, I understand the defense called expert witnesses today. So who testified?
That's right. The defense's first expert witness was Dr. Modivian, a social psychologist who testified on the importance of context in decision making. For example, he studied how Nazi Germany was possible, you know, how normal people could do terrible things. And not surprisingly, his basic thesis, which he called the fundamental attribution error, played directly into the entrapment defense. You know, that humans tend to exaggerate the role of the individual and ignore the context in which decisions are made. He also brought up the well-known Milgram study on obedience. In this study, a group of normal, healthy individuals is divided into two groups, the teachers and the students. And every time the students made an error, the teacher delivers an electric shock and increases the voltage by 15 volts. And the result of the experiment shows that 60% of normal, healthy people will keep on delivering shocks all the way to life-threatening levels.
So what's next in the Mohammed Mohammed trial?
Well, the defense rested today, so Joe's out of a not job. The closing arguments will be tomorrow, and anyone out there who has not been down to the courthouse, 1000 Southwest 3rd Avenue, wants to show up for that 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. Closing arguments tomorrow, and then it'll be in the jury's hands.
Thank you very much, Joe. We've been speaking with KBOO reporter Joe Meyer, who's been reporting live from outside the federal courtroom in Portland, where Mohammed Mohammed is facing the potential of life in prison if found guilty of terrorism charges.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News at 5:30, followed by a special KBOO 45th anniversary special. Former KBOO public affairs programmers Sharon Wortman and Sandy Palshuk discuss what it was like to be programmers in the earlier years of KBOO public affairs at 6 p.m. And then at 7 o'clock, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather forecast calls for a chance of rain with a high of 47 degrees.
It's 5:17. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
What a satisfying sight it would have been for the public to see Lloyd Blankfein, Jamie Dimon, and other high-rolling Wall Street banksters in handcuffs for having illegally foreclosed on the homes of hundreds of thousands of American families. But no. Instead of the kingpins of finance finally having to take responsibility for evicting so many people and wrecking the nation's housing market, not a single one has even been pursued by the law. Rather, federal regulators have negotiated a secret deal with Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, Citigroup, and nine other mortgage lending giants, letting banks pay $10 billion in penalties to end the case against them. The lesson here is clear. If your crime is vast enough, forget doing time. You don't even personally pay the fine. You just unleash your mad dog lawyers to cut a deal, shifting the cost of your felonious profiteering scheme onto your bank shareholders. Letting the chief schemers deflect responsibility also has zero deterrent effect on their future scheming, and it destroys public trust in the notion of equal justice for all. It's not fair, we shout in exasperation. But the big shots shout back, fair? That's where you take your pig to win a blue ribbon. This is Wall Street, baby. Grab all you can. So they're still there, still scheming, profiting, and grinning. In the same week that Goldman Sachs agreed to pay a fine for its illicit treatment of homeowners, it announced that CEO Lloyd Blankfein was awarded some $19 million in pay, including a $6 million bonus. Likewise, J.P. Morgan agreed to a sweetheart settlement for its mortgage malfeasance. Then, a week later, it delivered an $11.5 million paycheck to its chief, Jamie Dimon. This is Jim Hightower saying, anyone who says crime doesn't pay simply is not paying attention to Wall Street.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
In the midst of a controversy over police oversight, Portland Police Chief Mike Reese announced today that he plans to remove Lieutenant Todd Wyatt from his sex crimes unit. Wyatt has been accused of sexual harassment of multiple women in the Police Records Division in 2010. Wyatt has also been accused of an off-duty road rage incident in Idaho in which he flashed his badge and revolver at another motorist. Despite a 5-1 vote by the Portland Police Review Board to fire Wyatt, Reese demoted him to a position in charge of the sex crimes unit. The position put him in daily contact with one of the victims of his physical sexual harassment. Also today, a former employee at the Multnomah County Jail at Inverness filed a lawsuit of nearly $1 million in damages, charging a corrections officer with sexual harassment. Officer Eddie Miller, who is named in the lawsuit, was previously found guilty of sexually abusing an inmate and sentenced to 2 years probation. For more on the story, KBOO's Janka Soderberg spoke with Dan Handelman of Portland Cop Watch.
I wonder if you can comment on today's report that Officer Wyatt is now being transferred out of the sex crimes unit that he was head of.
Yeah, well, I think it's about time. It's very strange that Chief Reese, after refusing to fire Wyatt for inappropriate behavior that has gotten other officers fired, and particularly that inappropriate behavior with female subordinates, that he would choose to put him in the sex crimes unit. And then, as it turns out, where one of the people he sexually harassed actually still works.
Well, do you think that having someone who has been accused of sexual harassment in the unit investigating sex crimes creates a chilling effect for women who want to report and have sex crimes investigated?
Oh, I'm sure it does. I think they have to be careful about who they choose in picking somebody like Lieutenant Wyatt. It was just completely inappropriate and excusable.
This isn't the only accusation that Lieutenant Wyatt has had to deal with. I understand he's also been found guilty of road rage incidents?
Right. He had a road rage incident where he was driving in Idaho and flashed his badge and gun at another driver. And then when they were asking him about why he behaved that way, instead of calling the police in Idaho, he said, well, next time I'll just crash into the guy and avoid all his problems. Instead of saying, you're right, it was inappropriate, it was unprofessional, I should have called the police, he made a comment he'd rather crash his car. And so they said that his responses were inadequate. The police review board recommended that he be fired on a 5-1 vote, and the chief decided to demote him instead of firing him. And we referred to that in our letter supporting the IPR as part of the good old boys network, where it really feels like Chief Reese surrounds himself with mostly white men and forgives them for their white male behavior instead of demoting or firing them. And then, you know, the one case where he fired somebody, Officer Frashauer, we're still in court trying to make sure that he doesn't stay on. But his crime was, you know, the outrage about what happened to Aaron Campbell exactly 3 years ago today, I should add, was enough that Chief Reese agreed to fire him.
Well, and in Officer Wyatt's case, the demotion was to then head the sex crimes unit.
Right. Well, his demotion, to be clear, was from being a captain to being a lieutenant. And he could have been assigned anywhere as a lieutenant, but for some reason, it was decided to put him in the sex crimes unit. Which, you know, and according to the Police Review Board report, Captain Wyatt had 4 EEOC, you know, equal opportunity trainings about sexual harassment of employees. Even with 4 of these trainings, he inappropriately touched women. So over the years, we've seen a lot of what we call pervo cops, male cops usually, asserting their power and dominance over females. And most of the time, we've seen it against females out in the community. And occasionally, we do see these kinds of incidents where it also happens between officers and fellow officers.
We also have coming out today the story of a prison officer at Multnomah County Jail and now being sued for sexual harassment. Do you feel like there is a culture within the police department and within corrections of sexual harassment?
Well, as I said, it's not unique to the Portland police. And we read stories from all over the country about officers committing sex crimes. This Eddie James Miller was arrested last year for sexual contact with a inmate, and then apparently also was sexually harassing one of his fellow workers. And several years ago, in 2008, there was another a couple other Multnomah County deputies, one who pleaded no contest for romantic involvement with an inmate, and he got 1 year of probation, and one who kissed an inmate and received 18 months of probation. So the criminal penalties don't seem to be that severe when they're imposed. So.
What do you think that we should do in order to change this this culture of impunity?
Well, I think, first of all, we have to demand more transparency. And second of all, we have to work on getting either at the State Academy or in the local police advanced academy the training that I'm talking about, this some kind of gender parity training that goes beyond, you don't want to be sued when your female employees say you said something inappropriate or touched them inappropriately, that says, in our society, it's a male-dominated society, and it has been, and these are the ways that it's become this way. Because they're starting to do that now with race. The same thing needs to be done around gender. It's pretty plain and simple.
Again, I've been speaking with Dan Handelman with Portland Cop Watch on the issue of Officer Wyatt and other officers in the Portland police who have faced accusations of sexual harassment. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
A number of civil liberties groups have called on Congress to pass the Paycheck Fairness Act, a bill which would equalize the earnings of men and women. Senators Bobber Mikulski of Maryland and Rosa DeLauro of Connecticut are reintroducing the Paycheck Fairness Act. The bill has been stopped in the Senate twice, once in 2009 and again in June of 2012. This bill would provide an update to the Equal Pay Act of 1963, which turns 50 this year. According to the U.S. Census Bureau, women in the U.S. earn, on average, only 77 cents for every dollar men earn. The statistics are even worse for African American women, who earn approximately 64 cents for every dollar men earn. and Hispanic women earn only 55 cents to every white man's dollar. If passed, provisions of the bill would include stronger penalties against violators, a ban on retaliation against workers who inquire about their employer's wage practices, and a requirement that employers demonstrate that wage differentials stem from factors other than gender. If Congress does not pass the Paycheck Fairness Act, the American Civil Liberties Union called on President Obama to sign an executive order for wage fairness among federal employees.
Chuck Hagel, who will likely be confirmed as the next Secretary of Defense, has stated in the past that he would work to reduce the nation's nuclear arsenal. Hagel has been a longtime supporter of a movement called, quote, Global Zero, which pushes for the elimination of all nuclear weapons. He sent President Obama a letter in 2009 saying that Global Zero was working on developing a pragmatic plan for the reduction and eventual elimination of nuclear weapons. The Global Zero envisions a 90% cut in the United States nuclear stockpile by the end of the decade. A month later, Obama gave a speech saying that the United States has a, quote, moral responsibility to begin reducing its nuclear arsenal. But Washington policy experts predict that Hagel will not push so hard for full nuclear disarmament once he takes office. Officials close to Obama have told reporters that he will likely endorse downsizing the U.S. nuclear arsenal in the coming years.
The Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife will resume the hazing of sea lions below the Willamette Falls on February 4th. California sea lions congregate below the falls to feast on threatened salmon and steelhead swimming upstream to spawn. Using a training technique called hazing, wildlife officials will begin using noise-making deterrents to scare the sea lions away in early February. Officials from the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife will fire specifically designed firecrackers and non-lethal seal bombs from the catwalk above the fish ladders to scare the sea lions downstream. The idea is to allow more threatened spring chinook and winter steelhead to get past the sea lions to spawn. As part of a 3-year pilot program aimed at reducing the threats to federally protected fish, the hazing effort will be conducted every day from dawn until dusk through April 30th. Hazing efforts were suspended last year due to funding issues, but the Oregon legislature announced $113,000 to pay for the next 3 months. This is the program's final year.
A federal judge approved a record $4 billion criminal settlement between BP and the Justice Department today. The British oil company pled guilty to 14 criminal charges and has agreed to pay $4 billion in penalties for the 2010 Gulf oil spill. The company claims to have spent over $24 billion for other settlements and cleanup efforts. While the government's criminal case against BP comes to a close, photographic evidence of new oil slicks have forced BP and federal agencies to continue their investigation of environmental damage. Wings of Care, an environmental nonprofit monitoring the situation in the Gulf, reports that several large oil slicks are currently growing near the site of the 2010 oil spill. Last October, the group discovered a four-mile oil slick near the disaster site. That slick has grown by 3 nautical miles in the past 4 months. Last week, the same group discovered another slick of around the same size, just 12 miles off the southern tip of Louisiana. And the emerging attention of these slicks could increase BP's legal troubles. The oil giant still faces civil charges for violating the Clean Water Act. That trial is scheduled to begin in late February.
Fish biologists are blaming a water supply problem for the death of 60,000 Chinook salmon at an Idaho fishery. The Idaho Department of Fish and Game reports that several supply valves controlling water delivery were blocked, reducing the flow to a trickle. The problem was found to affect two salmon release groups, the South Fork Summer Chinook Group and the Johnson Creek Summer Group. About 11% of the fishery's inventory was affected by the loss. At the McCall Hatchery in Idaho, salmon are raised and released in order to supplement natural fish production in certain areas along the Salmon River. Officials say the death of the 60,000 fish is the first such problem in 30 years.
President Barack Obama made an announcement Tuesday in Las Vegas, Nevada, urging Congress to get millions of illegal immigrants on a clear path to citizenship. President Obama is asking for the House, which is made up of mostly Republicans, to work on a better immigration reform while maintaining the rate of businesses who employ people illegally low and tightening security at national borders.
I'm here today because the time has come for common sense, comprehensive immigration reform. The time is now. Now's the time. Now's the time. Now's the time. Now's the time. I'm here because I'm here because most Americans agree that it's time to fix a system that's been broken for way too long.
The American Civil Liberties Union, or ACLU, gave their response to President Obama's announcement as well. KBU Sequoia Wright spoke with Chris Rickard of ACLU more about what the President Tuesday about the President Tuesday announcement.
I am speaking with Chris Rickard of ACLU. And Chris, go ahead and tell our listeners about ACLU's response to President Obama's immigration announcement today.
Sure. Well, I'd like to start by saying how commendable it is and how excited we are that the president laid out so eloquently why a roadmap to citizenship for about 11 million aspiring citizens who work in our communities, who are our friends, who are our neighbors, is vital as a matter of American values, American history, and also a priority for him in his second term. We think that the exploitation that has resulted from having undocumented people be in second-class status is long overdue to end, and that's the top line benefit of what the president was saying today. We do have some concerns, however, about aspects of the announcement and in terms of the fact sheet that was accompanying it. The president did not move off what has been a four-year period of intense enforcement activity, both at the border and in the interior. The border is over-resourced. Even the chairman of the House Appropriations Committee has called it a mini-industrial complex. It's divorced from true border security needs. It's divorced from what border communities are saying about the safety of their cities and the abuses that have accompanied the massive escalation in border security. So we're disappointed in the president's enforcement